This is Josh Lindley from Bartender Atlas. You're listening to the Whiskey Topic Podcast on Whiskey.Buzz. If you like what you're hearing, support us on the Patreon to get exclusive content from Mark Bylock, the dreamiest whiskey man alive.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Devin. How's
it going? Today we're going to be tasting some very special brown spirits.
Oh, I hope it's whiskey because this is the whiskey topic.
Well, you know, when sometimes you drink something like, say, the Glenfiddich 21-year-old, which is a truly sensational whiskey that's out right now, and they say it's finished in Caribbean rum casks.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what is that?
Be interesting to know what that was. Those rums taste like?
I just assume it's like a, I don't know. I don't even know what that means. I just assume it's like a marketing lingo. Are there even Caribbean rum casks?
Yes, they do use those, and that's a very great whiskey. But I tell you, I met a woman who comes from Guyana who actually happens to be a blender in at El Dorado at Diamond Distillery. And she brought with her some rum. It's called Enmore, which is distilled in the only wooden coffee still in North America. She brought with her some other whiskeys that are made in other wooden pot stills. So, pardon me, other rums that are made in wooden pot stills. So, why don't we try those, and then for the rest of this festival, let's see if we can detect Caribbean rum notes in our whiskeys.
Oh, that sounds terrific.
Whiskey, whiskey, the singer's getting sore. We raise the roof, now we're lowering the floor. The band is blistered, but we got a little more. When I say one, two, you say three, four. One, two, three, four.
Welcome to the Whiskey Topic. That was a really great start to this podcast. I love the way you described what we're doing here today. I was going to say, you come up to me, Devin, and you're like, hey, I bought alcohol the first time in 10 years, and you happened to buy rum. It wasn't even whiskey.
I bought three bottles of rum. It's amazing, but these rums are really very special rums because each one is made in a single still. We have some that's made in a wooden coffee still. It's the only wooden coffee still left in the world that's operating. We have some that is made in a single wooden pot still, and we have some that's made in a wooden pot stills, but it's a double wooden pot still. So these are really special whiskeys. This is like the source. These are the whiskeys that they blend to make all the wonderful El Dorado rums. So I thought we could just try these, and I have to say they're pretty inviting. And like you say, I haven't been spending a lot of money on booze just because it's overwhelming how much arrives at the door from the whiskey fairy. But when I saw those three bottles here in Fredericton, I simply had to have them. So
I sneaked ahead of you and I had a sip, and this doesn't taste like any rum I've had before.
No, it doesn't, does it?
This is like a whiskey drinker's rum. Because if you poured this to me and told me it was a whiskey, I've been like, I wouldn't even be that surprised.
It's whiskey, but it tastes like it's finished in rum casks, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm going to go ahead and taste it. I love the tasting glassware that you're using here, and I haven't ever actually tried this before. We're nosing in a standard Glencairn glass. It's actually an El Dorado Glencairn, but we're tasting in these custom-made Delta paper coffee cups.
Delta, owned by the Marriott company.
Yes, and it gives a very different flavor between the nose and the sip. So I'll take a sip myself.
Yeah, yeah. We are here at the New Brunswick Spirit Festival in Fredericton. We do this. I try to come down here every year as much as possible every year. We're going to be selling books today because we're the big show opens up in about 5 hours. And Devin and I are going to do the thing that we do is we go to shows and we sell books and we sign books and we mostly just meet a lot of wonderful people and shake a lot of hands, and talk a lot about whiskey, which is really great. And you and I sharing a table is great. Between you and Fred Minnick, I've shared the table with Fred Minnick once. You and I have shared a table many times. You both sell more books towards the end of the event, and I sell more books at the start of the event. And I think that's always a good pairing because that means we're working to our strengths.
I think it's always good to have more than one author at an event because something I learned in a marketing class. The best place to open a restaurant is next door to a restaurant because people will go down there and they'll say, well, no, we're not sure what we want, but if we go there, you know, there'll be some choice. And it's the same with books. We kind of create a critical mass. And Mark, yeah, I enjoy working with you. I remember the first time we met. Uh-huh. Do you remember? I sent you a note because you had put something on Twitter or somewhere saying, you know, I've got a book coming. And I sent you a note and said, you know, Mark, we should meet and we should have a chat. And we met for lunch. You picked a restaurant in Toronto.
Oh, yes.
We met for lunch. And
that was like a Thai restaurant or something, right?
I can't remember. Probably was. We recognized each other from our Twitter photos. Mm-hmm. And when we sat down and had a great conversation, and ever since then, we've kind of been supporting each other as writers. So I'm pretty kind of interested to learn about your writing process and your publishing trials and tribulations, and certainly look great looking for an opportunity to talk about mine. And maybe people will even take an interest in putting a book in somebody's Christmas stocking this year.
Yes, so wouldn't that be wonderful?
Your book, Mark, is called
The Whiskey Cabinet.
The Whiskey Cabinet. The Whiskey Cabinet. Mm-hmm. And my book is called Canadian Whiskey, The New Portable Expert.
Edition 2.
It's the second edition. That's right. And we'd love to see you guys order those on Amazon or buy them at Chapters. But anyways, let's get on with chatting. Tell me how you got interested in writing a whiskey book, Mark.
So that's a funny story. When I was in kind of finishing up high school and going to university, I wrote a lot of sci-fi and fantasy. Like I think by second year university, I've written like three, but none of them were published, but just like three books. I didn't even try publishing them. And so I had this strong desire to write. I also was drinking a lot of whiskey in my 20s. I had a good contract job, so I was able to buy the $60 whiskeys at a very young age when everybody else was buying the $25 or cheaper. So I did a lot of writing, and then, you know, corporate life took over, and I basically stopped writing for 10 years, for a decade. Mm-hmm. Corporate life. You do emails, you do conference calls, and that's all I ever had time to do. But you know, in my 30s, I started to have a little bit more free time, and I was able to. I had a friend, Suresh Das. Now he does, he works for the CBC now, and he does like a lot of food tours around Toronto. And he does food tours now that like he'll take you to like the mom and pop store places in strip malls that you'd never heard of otherwise, and to just delicious stuff. And that's what he does for the CBC. Back then, he had a website called Spotlight Toronto. And so him and I met through Twitter, hilariously enough. He was doing like a food event or something, and you know, we met and we became fast friends and just immediately hit it off. And he's like, you know, you like whiskey and you like writing. Why don't you combine these two things? And I'm like, who's going to read about whiskey? Who's going to read? And he's like, you would not believe. He goes, whiskey's the next big thing. And he's telling me this in like 2008, 2009. He's like, whiskey's going to be the next big thing. Like, it's the next big thing. If you look at here, it's the next big thing. You just jump on this train right now and write. And I kind of said, okay, like, this is good. I think at this time I did a golf trip to Scotland. I'm a retired golfer. I don't golf anymore. But I did golf in my 20s and 30s for business, because it was a corporate thing. That's what you did. And so I golfed and I went to Scotland and really just fell in love at that point. Visited my first distillery, and that's a very common story, right? And so at that point, I was all in. Like before that, I just bought a bottle every 3 months, drank it, and brought another bottle. So I was all in at that point. So I combined these two things, and then the year I got the contract was 2013, where I think there was a visible gap in the market. They had a lot of advanced whiskey books, like you think of the Whiskey Bible, the Jim Murray's. They had like those big books, the Bloom book, like just giant whiskey books, but they didn't have a lot of entry-level books. Uh-huh. So the Whiskey Cabinet, I got approached by a publisher to do the Whiskey Cabinet. They just immediately signed me on. I said, hey, what's your concept? This, that's great. That's what we're thinking. This is a gap in the market. That's what we want to print. And then at that same year, a lot of other great writers got released as well. There's like a bit of a there's like three or four writers that had released whiskey books around the same time. So we all kind of have very similar concepts too, because it was a very missing part of market. Mm-hmm. And so that's how that happened. And so I got the book deal, and that's later on. That's how the podcast started, because I realized, oh, the books. You know, what am I going to do? Like, what's next? Like, it was already a dream of mine. I've always had a dream to publish a book. It's always been a dream of mine to do that. So once I hit that point, I'm like, oh, what do I do next? Like, and the podcast, I was a big podcast. I always do what I enjoy. So I enjoy writing. I enjoy drinking whiskey. I enjoy listening to podcasts. So I podcast. Like, I always do what I enjoy. And I think that's where the passion naturally flows through.
Oh, boy. Do you still do any sci-fi?
I do. I have a couple of manuscripts that I'm chopping around. One, like, it's very funny. The writing business is a very difficult thing. I've got one that nearly got sold, nearly was going to be a movie. Movie options. This is don't get too excited.
Oh, I understand.
Yeah, no, yeah. I just all that means is somebody buys the rights to do something for very little money, and they just kind of, you know, that doesn't really mean anything. But I had shopped around a couple times and had a couple of offerings. Working on something right now that might get turned into something. But it's the publishing deal of world is you never do it for money. And I think I've not the first person to say that you do it. It's almost like playing a lottery ticket, but you're spending, you know, 12 months of your life just to pick the numbers, and you're many hours a day, and then you finally have that lottery ticket, and you run it to the publisher, and then you just don't you have no control over it at that point. It just goes in its own way.
It becomes their book. You're right. And the other thing with publishing, of course, is no matter what anybody says, it's not real until the check clears the bank.
Yep.
Because anything can happen, which means that your book is no longer a priority, or maybe it goes wild and they want more quickly or things like this. So I hadn't heard that lottery analogy, but yeah, that fits.
It's definitely true with like sci-fi and fiction work specifically, because you're not guaranteed. Most books don't sell more than 500 copies. Mm-hmm. And it's like 1.5% sell more than 500 copies. You and I have done well in the whiskey community. But from like a sci-fi perspective, our sales are probably, you know.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah. We are, I think, both lucky in that we have a very supportive audience, and which is really helpful. And people are buying our books for gifts for people, but they're also telling their friends and so that. So yeah, it's still going. You know, I mean, after a few years, our books are both still selling, but you've got to do a new one, Mark.
Yeah, it's
2013.
I know.
2019. What's in the pipeline?
Yeah, I got trapped in one of those situations where I assumed I was going to be publishing a book next year, but like you said, priorities are changing, and you can tell like it was like the deal was almost inked, and you can tell how this stuff works. Like, if there's any hint of, you know, because of the taxations and tariffs and everything, if there's any sort of risk to something happening, and I'm writing a book primarily for North American audience, so it was there's anything, they're just like, whoop, you know, like maybe this isn't, because the publisher, you invest all your time, the publisher invests the money basically to bootstrap the publishing. So unfortunately, I thought I was going to have a book in 2020. I would have been knee deep in writing it right now in November, and it would have been due in January, but that did not happen. It's very sad.
Yeah, my friend wrote a book about Japanese whiskey and Japanese bars. Got it finished, met his deadline, got it in, and then what happened is the publisher decided to delay publishing by a year.
Oh, jeez.
Well, guess what? There's a lot of turnover in a year, especially when he's talking about bars and, you know, who where to go in Tokyo and in Japan.
Yeah.
So what it really means is you rewrite the book. And it's just, you know, very, very discouraging. But it's most encouraging when you come to an event like this one, mm-hmm. and you see people lining up for the book, and they want you to personalize it and sign it and things like that. It's a lot of fun. I have to say. And you're right. You're not going to make a fortune selling books unless you're Margaret Atwood.
Yeah, no. That's the lottery ticket, right? Very talented. No, not belittling what, you know, she's very talented, but it's just that's the luck, talent,
yeah,
and circumstances coming together.
Yeah.
And hard work.
Yeah.
Decades of hard work.
It's an interesting thing. But anyways, it's a lot of fun, and it's a community. And I'm glad that we're all friends, that we're not trying to steal each other's sales and things like that. But I'm going to a really cool event, mm-hmm. in Louisville on December 6th. It's called Bookstock.
Yes.
Bookstock.
Oh, I'm so jealous about that. That's amazing.
Are you think it's amazing? It's beyond amazing. You know, they're having like 16 authors that with books that sell well, top selling books, come all together, and we're going to talk about.
I was number 17 on the list, just never made it. No. It sounds great.
Yeah, so we're gonna debate each other, and we're gonna sign books, obviously, and probably drink and all kinds of things. So we have guys like Robert Simonson is going to be there. Yeah, who wrote the Martini book, and I think the greatest cocktail historian probably ever, Dave Wondrich, is going to be there. Karen Newman with her latest cocktail book will be there, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We have some whiskey books, and we have it's all whiskey or cocktails, so.
Yeah,
I'm very excited about that. I hope it becomes an annual event.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazing? We should do something in Toronto because we have so many authors in Toronto alone in the cocktail, kind of broader cocktail whiskey scene.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking of putting something together, but it would not be in Toronto.
You're going to go Ottawa?
I wouldn't do it in Ontario. I would do it someplace where it was a bit of an effort for people to get there, so you just get the top tier authors coming to the event, because that's what they've done, in Louisville is, they want people who really, have a well-established, long-established reputation. And it's, it's crazy the marketing that's going on for that.
So that's amazing. It looks really cool. It looks really cool. And it's the day of my, I think you're, the heel party. Come by afterwards if you're driving through. Listen, the other thing, I think the other thing too, you and I both have in common is we're lucky to have a very supportive network. Mm-hmm. We're lucky that the brands themselves support us as well. At least, they're very nice to us, even when we're not always nice to them, which I think is in our writing. Which I always respect a great deal, because we all have different goals in life, and it's nice to see that. But also our wives. Our wives are absolutely a big part of why we're able to do this. First of all, they put up with us traveling and drinking regularly. It's just and they also help in the kind of the behind-the-scenes business part of it as well.
Janet does so much behind-the-scenes work. She answers most of my emails. She really does.
Yeah.
And she tells me which ones I need to read. Because I get, more than 100 emails every day. She does all the logistical work and for the Canadian Whiskey Awards. That's a massive amount of work. So that whole thing is, I get the credit, but she does the work. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I could do this if I didn't have somebody at home who's so supportive. It's really it's very not just encouraging, but it takes away a lot of the distractions. So it's also fun doing it together, as you've got your couple and you got something you're doing jointly, and it makes a huge difference. And I don't think I would want to do it if I was working on my own. It would just be, I think I would just get tired of my own company.
Right. I mean, you do. You said this to me early on, and I didn't get it that well early on. I probably didn't get a lot of advice you gave me early on, because I feel like you can't really absorb good advice until you're at a certain stage. And I'm sure you gave me all this terrific advice, and it didn't absorb because I didn't know where it was. I didn't have that experience yet, but one of the things that he always said is writing can be a very lonely business. It could be very, very lonely work. And I think I feel that more now than ever before, because you do a lot of things that you put on the limb. I think before, before Nicole and I had kids, she almost proofed everything I ever wrote. Uh-huh. And now there's just no time. There's just no time for that. Nicole's, we're both busy with the kids. Nicole's primarily the primary caretaker. So we don't have that time. And when we do, we watch an hour at most of TV in a day, probably 30 minutes if we're lucky. If we're having a busy day, rather. And so it is more lonely putting things out without having sort of that support in before things go out. But it's also freeing as well. I think it's, kind of works both ways. But we socialize a lot, which I love doing events like this. But the other part of it is a very individual.
It's a lonely life as a writer if you're on your own. There's no question about that. Yeah. So, anyways, well, we're lucky we both got support and we both got kids and, you know, families and other things going on in our lives.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
What do you think of that, that Enmore, that rum from El Dorado that comes from a wooden coffee still?
Amazing. So it noses really well in these coffee cups when it's like the coffee cup is empty and it's just like the wet paper, and it just noses like a beautiful brown caramel sugary goodness. Like it's a beautiful nose. On the palate though, it's not as sweet as I'd expected from a rum. That's a bad, maybe bad comparison because there's certainly rums that aren't that. But it's not rummy. Me as a very very inexperienced rum drinker, I would just say this is not rummy. It is very whiskey.
Well, I think you're noticing two things there. You're noticing some earthy notes for sure, but you're also noticing some barrel tones, barrel notes that are coming through in that. And yes, but you know the barrier between whiskey and rum. It depends where you live. It could be more or less. I'm just thinking, you know, like in America, you know, United States, where there are practically, there are billions of rules about how you can make whiskey, but those rules mean essentially say you can do anything you want. Mm-hmm. And they make whiskey out of sorghum juice.
Yeah. What is sorghum? Explain
which is it. Which yeah. is like which is it well it's a plant that has a stalk, a cane like somewhat like sugar cane, not nearly as robust. It, you know, makes a little spray of seeds which might look better in a vase. And but you can squeeze the juice out of that. It's got a lot of sugar in it, and then you can ferment that and you can make a drink. Well, if you were allowed to make rum from anything other than sugar cane, I think they would call that rum.
Right.
But because they can't, and because it's in America that they think of grain as the whole plant, in Canada we think of grain only as the seeds, they make it out of sorghum juice. And so I think that is really kind of a transition between whiskey and rum. It's rum in every respect except legally, and legally it's whiskey. So I think that we need to taste brown spirits. Now I know that you know we started out in whiskey, and I started out in single malt Scotch. But when I remember going to a tasting where they were pouring old spirits, old rum, and these rums were more than 20 years old, rums and cognacs and whiskeys. And the point of the tasting, and I mean, they had selected specific ones, but they were all prominent, well-known brands. The point was that eventually these flavors converge because you have time in the barrel, and in the barrel you're getting a lot of oxidation, which is changing the flavors that are in there, which is changing all the congeners, not just the alcohol. You get, some ethanolysis breaking down the wood in the barrel, so you're getting more wood notes coming in there, but they're not those harsh wood notes that you might get normally. And so eventually the different brown spirits do converge more and more in flavor, and so you get the flavors of maturation becoming more prominent, and the flavors of the feedstock, you know, be it the grapes, fruit, grain, or sugar cane, you get those flavors somewhat attenuated. Mm-hmm. So, I don't feel remotely tied to drinking just whiskey, even though whiskey really is no matter where you get it, it's a sensational drink. One of the things that I really love about most of the whiskey that we get these days, especially that coming from the large producers, is that there are very few that are actually, there's actually something wrong with them, because there's such great quality control in whiskey, because it's a global market.
Yeah.
And so your whiskey has to compete everywhere. Things, if you think about something like beer, for example, beer really only competes in the local market because, it's expensive to ship water, and beer is mostly water. So really what you get is these companies, they really are producing fabulous products. I mean, even a whiskey that a lot of people disparage, but it's the best-selling whiskey in the world, Jack Daniel's, even that has some very, very appealing notes, and there are situations where even a whiskey like that is really well worth drinking. Now, I think this Enmore that we have just tasted from El Dorado, I think that that is really a very good whiskey lover's dram.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so nice.
I think it is too. And there's another one that's made in Nova Scotia from Glenevan. It's again, Caribbean rum, but they mature it in casks that have had Glenevan whiskey in them. And that also is kind of a whiskey drinker's rum. So it's you know, there are different ways of getting it. But yeah, aging is one way.
Yeah.
And this Enmore, I think, is really a... I know, I'm really very impressed with it. I remember having tasted it at the distillery, and I was excited enough that I thought I'd buy a bottle if I saw one, and I saw one in Fredericton, so I snapped it up.
That's yeah. Amazing.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. Anyway, well, let's get back to our life as authors.
Yeah, so you've been doing this for longer than I have. I one of the things that I really loved seeing is when we were both at Tales of the Cocktail, and this would have been, I guess, maybe 2015 or 2016, and the amazing amount of people you had coming up to you, like you had clearly already, like, just you've already had this established audience in a time where there weren't that, you know, that in the time where whiskey was just, you know, pushing forward, but you wrote a Canadian whiskey book, which I think makes it different. You didn't write a whiskey book for everybody. You wrote a book for people that love Canadian whiskey, and to have, you know, a niche of a niche in that point, but exploded that popularity. How did that come up? Like, why even write a book about Canadian whiskey? That's probably the first question, but because I mean, you wrote it before. I mean, really before.
This is totally by chance. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, I was like absolutely dedicated to single malt scotch, and I thought, if it's not scotch, it's crap. Well, that is total sheer utter nonsense, and it's something that I learned through blind tastings, you know, that there are other whiskeys out there that when I thought they were single malt scotch, I loved them. And when I found out afterwards, I wasn't uncomfortable. I just opened my eyes. I started getting interested in the Canadian whiskies and Canadian distilleries. And I've been driving by these distilleries, so I started compiling binders for my own use. You know, a binder about Black Velvet, a binder about Hiram Walker, you know, and a binder about, you know, various distilleries in Canada. And after a while, my daughter said to me, "You know, Dad, you're writing a book." And I said, "Holy crow, this would make a great book. I've got all this research." And I mean, and when this was a long time ago, so I talked to the people who then were long retired from these distilleries, so I could get the real skinny. So I wasn't talking to marketing people. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, marketing people have their place, but they tell you the story in such a way that it makes their distillery or their whiskey look the best. And I started putting together this plan for the book, you know, chapter plan, how would I organize it, and so on. And when it went out to the publishers, I had a deal like in 5 days. It was amazing, totally amazing. Everybody thought it was great, and it was with McClelland and Stewart. For Pete's sake, that's the most prestigious publisher in Canada, and they bought this book and they loved it. Well, the first one third of the book is essentially a primer on any kind of whiskey. Yep. If you read the first third, you understand scotch, and you understand bourbon, and you understand Canadian whiskey and Japanese and whatever, because it talks about the wood and the water and where the flavors come from, how flavors develop, what they taste like, and things like that. But then you get into the history, and then you get into the real Canadian stuff. And I was just delighted to see that book come out, and it did well enough that we did a second edition. Now, the first book was released kind of as a Canadiana book, and so it went with McClelland and Stewart. But since then, the publishers have amalgamated, so now it's on the Appetite by Random House imprint, which deals more with food and drink. So it's going through a different channel this time, mm-hmm. and so different marketing people, different places, placements in bookstores and things like that. And so it's got a lot of pickup there as well. And it still sells well. It still does. So, I think it's the only book out there on Canadian whiskey. And it's not the first book on Canadian whiskey, but it's the first one that was truly comprehensive, that really talked about everything from soup to nuts. And I don't know if I could write that book today, because a lot of the people who gave me the early information, told me how Canadian whiskey works, what's going on, a lot of them are no longer around. And more than that, I think we have it's more difficult to get information these days, because we have communications departments and we have marketing people, and they want you to tell their story their way. And that makes it very difficult, you know, because, you know, they'll tell you great, wonderful stories, but they may have been massaged, you know. So, and I remember, you know, I visited every distillery in Canada, and it was like they were shocked. It was the first time a writer had ever been to the distillery, and man, oh man, they opened the doors, and I got all the secrets. It was really very, very cool. And, So anyways, I really enjoyed writing that book. And I've got a new book coming out in March.
Yes, tell us about that.
Yeah, it's called The Definitive Guide to Canadian Distilleries. This book has been a year and a half out of my life of just tortuous research and writing. We did the proposal, and there were 130 distilleries in Canada at the time, because it covers all the big distilleries, but all the small ones as well. So we did a timeline based on 130 distilleries, how long would it take us to write it, and then, of course, distilleries kept popping up. Come on, guys, slow down. So I think there were 257 by the time we finished, which meant that our deadline to get the manuscript in for January 1st, 2019, it was just blown. We certainly had more than 130 distilleries covered by then, but we had so many more we had to visit and research and write about. And so eventually, I think there were 257, and I think 11 of them didn't make it. It was just too late, you know, just too much. And of course, they kept having to add more pages. First, they add 16 pages to the book, and then they add another 16 pages. And of course, you're trying to keep the price down, and when you add pages, the price goes up. So then they said, okay, well, we'll do soft cover instead of hard cover, because that knocks another $2 off the price. And
right.
So it's been, but anyway, 3 or 4 weeks ago, we finally got the final edit done and got it. It's beautiful, full color front to back, custom drawn maps where all the distilleries are. It's a really wonderful, wonderful book. It's going to be out the 31st of March in 2020. So people can watch for that. You can order it now on Amazon. And I tell you something about pre-orders. When a book is pre-ordered, that's really helpful to the author, because places like Chapters see, lots of pre-orders, we should buy a lot and put them in our store. It tells the salespeople at the publishing department that the book is going to be popular, so they print more. And it tells the bookstores the book is going to be popular, so they buy more. So I'd really encourage everyone to pre-order that.
Yeah, and you told me this when you were releasing the second edition. You're like, don't pre-order one, pre-order three, because it does. You know, you're going to give it to family anyway. You're going to give it. You're going to give the book as a gift to other people as well. So order one for yourself, and just think of future gifts, and order a couple more. Just to mirror that, the pre-orders are so important. Without them, if you don't have many pre-orders, that could be very costly to the way the book goes. Yeah. And you know, my book's probably a good example of that. I did not have very many pre-orders in the system on Amazon specifically before the book got published, and so it sold well like about 4 or 5 weeks after it was published. So at some point, it had picked up enough momentum, and it had that mass appeal where I famously bragged that I outsold Jim Murray for a whole 4 or 5 days on Amazon in the US. Jim Murray was on his fourth or fifth month of publishing, and so it's not the same comparison at all. It's entirely a joke, meant as a joke, but I became a top seller on Amazon that way. But because the pre-orders weren't there, Amazon would only order 75 books at a time, and they would sell out of those, and then the book would be listed as not available, waiting for blah 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 for 3 or 4 days. And so slowly ramped up, but that was like a period of, you know, 6 to 8 weeks where the book was just always sold out, and then you would come in and it would just sell out. It was an endless process. So pre-orders, if you're going to buy the book, just please pre-order it. And that helps out everybody immensely.
Yeah, it does help a lot. Yeah. There's a lot of taking a deep breath when you publish a book, because you can really get a lot of anxiety if you take it too seriously. And watching the Amazon numbers, man, you got to try not to do that, because they're often not a true indicator of how popular the book is.
Oh, yeah.
And you're in there randomness. You know, having heartbreak, and meanwhile, somebody else is selling, you know, loads of them. It's a funny kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I was doing a whiskey tasting in Whitby at a barbecue place. And one of the reasons the book sold really ridiculously well was John Gruber, not famous in the broad sphere, but like if you're an Apple technology person, a well-known name, he publishes Daring Fireball. He bought a copy of my book and had bought it, and then had put it on his blog, which was, you know, it's a top, whatever, 30, 100, I can't remember what it was at the time, blog. And he was a big fan of it, which I was very humbled by, because he comes from the newsprint magazine media. So he's far more of a perfectionist about how things look than I am. And so it was very, very, very nice that it was a very good compliment to the publisher for setting up the way they did. And so I was starting a tasting, and 10 minutes before I went, I got like a million text messages and DMs and Twitters. And I'm like, John Gruber posted your book. And I was like, it was like getting that push. Right, that last like, oh wow, this is gonna be a big deal. So I remember I was probably the worst tasting I've ever done, because I was like 45 minutes of talking about whiskey, and the whole time in my head I'm thinking like, wow, I might actually sell some copies of the book. so that was a fun story. And he told the story on his podcast, how I reached out to him and said, hey, I'll send you a complimentary book, just, you know, give me your address and I'll send it to you. And I sent him the book went into sale in January 1st or January 2nd in the US. And I sent him this, I think, on the 24th or 25th, and the 24th, I guess, must have been. And he literally posted a photo of my book. Hey, you know, I just happened to have ordered this. So I was offering to send him a book. Meanwhile, he had ordered it. And then, and it shouldn't have even gotten to his house on the 24th, because as far as I knew, distribution in the U.S. didn't start till January. Uh-huh. Amazon wasn't, you know, so anyway, great story. He talked about it on his podcast as well, from his perspective of like, oh, yeah, like I just got this book and the author happened to email me, which I thought was very funny.
That you're lucky when things like that happen. Sometimes you just get something out of the blue, and that's what it can really push you over the top.
Yeah, no, it made a huge difference, and certainly, especially in U.S. and sales, and you need to be like, that's just what it is. Got to do. You need that luck along with having a product
that people are going to be happy with when they finish reading it.
Yeah,
that's good. Should we open another bottle?
Let's do it. So the first one we had was the only functioning wooden coffee still,
globally.
Sure. And
I think these things taste good enough out of the coffee cups that I don't think we need to pour that into a Glencairn.
Yeah, no, I think we're good. Yeah. And, plus the we're getting some nice notes here from the paper and the glue that, keeps everything together, which I think is complementary to the rumminess of this. Oh, this is even darker and funkier.
And oilier. I would call this rum El Dorado Versailles, because I live in Canada and that's how we pronounce Versailles. They say in Guyana, where it's made, they say Versailles. So this is El Dorado Versailles or El Dorado Versailles. This is made in a single pot still. The pot still is made out of rum, and it's Guyanan hardwood that it's made out of. And you know how they heat a wooden still? They heat it with steam coils. Mm-hmm. And this rum is really quite a heavy rum, a heavy-bodied rum. I remember this rum well. From when I was at the distillery a couple of years ago, but it's still going to be a revelation to me drinking it again now.
This is a funky rum. It's got these.
Wow. That's so bold.
I can't describe that flavor profile. I don't know what it is.
Well, there's Dundry. There are Dundry notes there, and I know they don't use Dunder in Guyana.
There's definitely like the green apple-y kind of underlayer of beneath all that kind of sweetness. And
yeah, it's not sweet. There's an earthiness to it. There's a
Oh, it's not like sweet like hot like, rum. No.
Like it's like almost herbal, but not really distinct enough to be herbal.
Yeah, like that.
This is, I think, is a base that they would lay some other flavors over, or they might use this to label, because that Enmore is just so gorgeous the way it is right now.
The it's peppery, mm-hmm. oaky, spicy, like you would have in any whiskey. That's just so, it's got such a peppery note to it that pretty much overcomes everything. I there's an herbal note. I can't identify it out of this coffee cup.
Well, I wanted to, when I saw these three rums for sale, I wanted to buy them because the opportunity to taste what the still does, because remember, they're all starting with the same spirit. The opportunity to find out what the still, or pardon, with the same mash, what the still does to the fermented mash, I think is something that people really don't think about. Mm-hmm. You know, they think the flavor all comes from the barrel. Of course, that's not the case. Or they think, you know, the yeast is important, or this, whatever they've heard. But there's a really cool thing you can do with Canadian whiskey to really understand how the still shapes the flavor of the spirit of the whiskey you're eventually going to drink. And that is to take a bottle of, say, Whistle Pig, mm-hmm. Whistle Pig 10-year-old made in Canada.
Yeah.
And taste how rich and robust that is, and then taste a glass of, or first of all, taste a glass of Alberta Premium, which is a 5-year-old. They both are made from 100% rye grain. There's nothing but rye used in those. They both are made from the very same mash, mm-hmm. and they are two totally, entirely different whiskies. With the Alberta Premium, they strip all the rye notes out of it. And with the Whistle Pig, all the rye notes are concentrated in their pot still. They have a big pot still at Alberta Distillers because it's of health and safety. It's not very pretty to look at, but it's and so you can see that the amount of rye in a whiskey is really not a very good measure of the flavor, because these are both 100% rye, yet they taste. You couldn't even tell that they work from the same distillery, never mind from the same mash. And that's why I was really interested in these three rums coming from Guyana, from each one from a different still, because you really get to see everything else is controlled. The only real effect here, difference, comes from the still. This, as it develops in my mouth, is becoming more, I'm getting more... blackstrap molasses, you know, kind of the bitter molasses, which is sweet but bitter at the same time. It's really quite flavorful. I like that. I'm really quite enjoying this. I say, if I was just sipping and pouring for friends, I'd pour the Enmore, and the Versailles, or Versailles, I would say. I'd save that for the aficionados. This has a long, long development in your mouth, though. Holy crow. Really changes on the palate.
I'm really hoping I can pick this up as well and bring it home with me, because it is so nice. I agree, because this has just got so many, it pops with so many flavors. I'm a little overwhelmed with how many flavors it pops. Like, you do need more time with this. I was just looking it up. It was the second edition of Little Book that contained old Alberta rye. It was the blend of American whiskey and Alberta. And I had that earlier this year, and immediately I was just like, Alberta Distillers rye is just there. And between visiting Whistle Pig a couple of times, you know, I've been there several times, and tasting kind of a lot of the whiskey that comes from there, it's the most distinct note I'll pick out on any whiskey. And I had no idea the second edition had any Alberta, and I just nosed it. I'm like, oh, this is reminding me of Alberta. And I taste it, I'm like, and I immediately just Googled it. Oh yeah, it's a mixture of Canadian, because Note 3 is a mixture of Knob Creek, Booker's, Baker's, whatever, and then one was something else, but 2 was a blend of the two.
Yeah, a lot of that, what used to be called Dark Batch in the States, that I think that's been discontinued because they need that whiskey to put into Beam American whiskeys. Because, of course, they're allowed to add Canadian whiskey. They just have to label it a different way. So I think a lot of our Canadian rye is going down there. Alberta Distillers, I think, is the rye distillery that every other distillery wants to be. Others want to make their rye taste like Alberta Distillers, and they can't. And no one is ever, ever, ever going to be able to replicate their process because they have some. They do something that no other distillery does. They grow in their distillery. They grow enzymes which break down the starch. And what they do is they just grow these enzymes. It's just like it's really a fungus that grows in the mash, and which creates these different enzymes. It's like the Japanese use to make their various spirits as well. And so, and these things you can't freeze dry them. They lose their effectiveness. They don't concentrate them. So they're not like commercial enzymes that some other distillers use. These are a broad spectrum enzyme that will break down all the different parts of the rye grain. So they get a lot more alcohol and a lot more flavor. And because they have to grow these, they're live. You get a very, very different effect. And this is why they can use 100% rye grain with no other malt or anything added. They don't use malted rye. They don't use commercial enzymes. And they produce, I think, the best rye whiskey on earth. I know there's some wonderful rye whiskey like the Millstone. It's beautiful whiskey. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anybody has ever produced rye consistently like Alberta Distillers. The other thing is, they don't get the same kind of foaming problems other people get because of these broad-spectrum enzymes that break down the proteins and break down the various components that might cause foaming if you use commercial enzymes or if you use malt or something like that. So they can produce 100% rye whiskey every day of the year. Obviously they stop once a year for cleanup, and they can produce so many different nuances of rye, like I said. And I really recommend people try Masterson's or Whistle Pig. Mm-hmm. Masterson's also comes from Alberta Distillers. Try that head to head with Alberta Premium. All very nice whiskeys, but really you'll find that the ones with a lot of rye flavor are so distinctly different from 100% rye grain that's been distilled a different way. So why did I get off on this tangent? Because the reason I'm tasting these different rums specifically is to taste the influence of the different still, the different distillation processes on the flavor of the final product.
So we have one more to go.
We do. If we have time, we can get to it. I would like to finish this first, Mark.
I was very impressed. I love the way. Yeah, that's a good distinction. In the United States, you can't. In the United States, you can't use any enzymes.
Sure, you can. People think that American whiskey is well controlled. This is nonsense. Total utter nonsense. Bourbon is only one of something like 35 different styles of whiskey. Bourbon is the only one that straight whiskey is the only one that have those regulations. You can use enzymes up the yin yang if you want.
You're good at this because you're absolutely right. I sometimes generalize American whiskey, but I'm really talking about straight rye and bourbons. And that's a lot of regulation there. Yeah. But if it's an American whiskey,
people have to understand that bourbon is popular now, but bourbon just about went out of business. American whiskey is a lot more than just bourbon, lot more. And, I mean, they can do things down there that we are just not allowed to do up here in Canada. They can add neutral spirits to their whiskey and call it whiskey, up to 80%. And it doesn't even have to be grain neutral spirits. It can be cane sugar, cane neutral spirits. They can do all kinds of things on there, but people have kind of, to make their own brands look great, they home in on bourbon and pretend that all the other different kinds of American whiskeys don't exist, but they do. This is why you want to get your information when you're writing a book from people who make whiskey, not from marketing people, not from brand ambassadors, not from people whose job and whose bonus depends on selling their own brand. So you really kind of have to dig down because, and this is where a lot of the myths originate. People, they say something because, it makes their brand maybe sell a little more and look a little bit better. And they're not lying, but they're just not telling the whole truth. I think it is very disingenuous to compare Canadian whiskey to bourbon, because bourbon is only one of many different kinds of American whiskey. You're better to compare Canadian whiskey to American whiskey. What can the Canadians do? What can the Americans do? And Canadians have a lot less room to work. We have, our rules are succinct, but they're very, very comprehensive, because there are things you just can't do in Canada. In America, they can sell whiskey that's not been aged. In Canada, it has to be aged for at least 3 years. Nobody does that. Everybody ages for at least 4. But, so it's a very... I think it's something that's becoming popular out there. And there was just an article in the spirits business, and I kind of flipped my lid. And
you did. I loved it.
And sent them a great long explanation, because people have got it wrong. And it is not doing Canadian whiskey any service, and it's not doing American whiskey any service to pretend that bourbon is the bourbon rules are the only rules for Canadian whiskey, for American whiskey. It's just not the case.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long history in the U.S. I'll speak of one rye producer, but they never really produced rye. They had rye in the name, and they went to somebody that's a flavoring person and had a flavoring agent develop that, because they could put 2.5% of whatever nut and sugary, flavory stuff into the drink, and so it was very young, non-rye whiskey, column distilled. Neutral grain, but because they added this additional flavoring agent, now they had an American whiskey. And because it said rye in the title, they got sued in the whole bit. But the whole idea being is that American, it is a very interesting category, because it's a category that bourbon manufacturers are stepping back into. So, we talked about Booker's Note, or there's Basil Hayden's, we mentioned the dark rye. These are traditional bourbons that made with all the rules of bourbon, and they're stepping out of the bourbon category and just stepping into this general American whiskey category, and saying, look, the consumer doesn't really necessarily say one way or another, oh, it's Basil Hayden, it's got to be a bourbon, or what have you. And so they step into this category that they can have a lot more freedom with what they make. So you really need to trust the brands more than anything else. And even that's already, like you said, one of my, I can't remember who told me this story, but it's a story from the 70s and 80s and 90s. They said, when the 90s started coming around, people started writing stuff down what brand ambassadors were saying. And typically they weren't brand ambassadors back then. It was the person that was running the distillery, or the person that was selling the whiskey. And they're like, at some point they're like, we gotta cool off on the stories, because people are writing, tweeting, eventually tweeting, but originally just writing. People are writing all this stuff down, and we gotta cool off on the stories. But even today, you can tell how every distillery has its own little story, and that story is just there to distinguish itself from the other distilleries in the community.
And guess what? You're right, Mark. American whiskey makers are starting to get away from following the bourbon rules and doing other things, making other American whiskeys. And guess what? These whiskeys are fabulous.
They're so good.
They're making wonderful, wonderful whiskeys. So I'm telling you, these whiskeys are going to become quite prominent in the market again. They really are, because those rules are not there to help make whiskey better. Those rules are there to categorize, to classify whiskeys. And if you really go through all of the whiskey regulations for America, what you find is that this isn't about making whiskey. This is about, if you make it this way, here's what you write on the label. So it's an entirely different process, an entirely different thought process. And the rules seem to be written on the basic assumption, basic false assumption that distillers are dishonest. In Canada, we say, you must do this, 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 and if you do, you can call it Canadian whiskey.
Yeah, High West is an early example of that, right? If High West was a pharmacist that came into the, had a tour of Maker's Mark and decided he loves whiskey, jumped into it with passion. There's so many stories in the industry like this. And he was selling pharmaceuticals. And he's like, wait, I can mix 8-year-old bourbons with 2-year-old young ryes, and I could just call it American whiskey and whatever, and people will buy it. And he's just like, yeah, well, let me just make great whiskey. Like, these are the rules. It has to be this old. He figured out what the categories were and just like, let me just make great whiskey. And really didn't make bourbon. I mean, they have bourbons and ryes as well, but primarily their best products are ones that get creative with. They're like, I don't care. We're just going to make American whiskey. It's not a rye. It's not a bourbon. Here's what it is. Enjoy.
Yeah, you're so right. But it also, consumers are, it used to be you were either a rye guy or you were a Scotch single malt guy like mm-hmm. I was for a long time. And I regret what I lost in those days, what I missed out on. Or you were just a bourbon guy or something like this. And nowadays people are not so loyal to a specific style because it's become okay to be seen drinking bourbon. In fact, it's pretty cool right now. It's become okay to be seen drinking Canadian whiskey or Japanese whiskey or Taiwanese or whatever. And so people shouldn't restrict themselves to one kind of whiskey because there are so many wonderful opportunities out there. And Mark, today we've poured three rums that you said are whiskey drinkers' rums. And so I'm really saying let's go beyond whiskey. Let's go to brown spirits altogether because there are some truly wonderful experiences waiting to happen with other spirits other than whiskey. And these rums, these three rums that we're tasting, I paid $90 a bottle for these, which I think to get this kind of flavor, I could probably get a bourbon this good for $90, but I couldn't get a scotch this good for $90. Now, I could probably get a scotch this good for $300. And the same with Canadian whiskey. You can get, oh man, those new Alberta premiums.
Yeah.
Have you tasted those?
So cheap and so great.
Somebody has to go into their marketing department, grab the person who sets the prices on these and throttle them because they're so cheap. Holy lifting. You know, these whiskeys.
20-year-old rye for $80.
Can you believe it? Can you believe 20-year-old rye for $80? It's unbelievable. Canadian whiskey is such a great bargain. And actually, you asked me how I got into Canadian whiskey, and that was another thing. It was a quarter the price of scotch.
Yeah.
And guess what? If I just want to have whiskey, and I found out that if I spend just $5 more for a bottle of Canadian whiskey, all of a sudden I'm drinking this really fabulous whiskey. The bottom shelf stuff, the stuff that we got drunk on in school and got hangovers, that stuff is not Canadian whiskey. It's like drinking the $14 scotch, single malt scotch that you can buy in Texas. You know what? It's whiskey, but it's certainly not going to get you back to buy another bottle.
That was my aversion to Canadian rye specifically, was the early university drinking, was that negative association with it. When I started writing the book, I'm like, okay, I'm going to have to get over my dislike of this specific rye note that I was just so tuned into palate-wise. And I did, because Masterson's, really, that's what did it. I had a bottle of Masterson's. I'm like, oh, this is great. And it just... That's great. And I was like, tell me about your palate, because you've been, you've gone through all the segments, but now because you did writing a book and finished a book on Canadian distilleries, I assume you tasted a lot of vodka, a lot of rums, a lot of other weird, things that distilleries were making. So tell me, did you experience issues? Like, I shouldn't say issues, but did you experience, like with your palate, like you didn't used to like this flavor, but now you drank like four different versions of this kind of thing. And now you decided, oh, I gained an appreciation for it. Is that happened? Cause you must have tasted a lot of different.
Yeah. I've published several thousand tasting notes, which are careful analyses of whiskeys. Mostly scotch, but also others as well. There are several whiskeys I've had that were really very unpleasant. Mostly they come from independent bottlers who don't have the same kind of quality control. This is one of the reasons why many of the major producers will not allow an independent bottler to say where they got their whiskey, because if they mess it up after it's left the plant, there's not much, and they don't want to get a bad reputation. So yeah, we know that Whistlepig comes from Alberta distillers, but they have a non-disclosure agreement. They're not allowed to say that. And you know, the same thing goes with Masterson's. And of course, you know, there are whiskeys, you know, that are Glenfarclas, but nobody knows they're Glenfarclas, or that are Macallan. Nobody knows they're Macallan, because Macallan won't let them put their name anywhere on that.
But they'll sell in the case barrel they whiskey. Mess it up. Yeah, but they'll sell the barrel whiskey. Yeah.
So there are things like this. How did I get used to that? Well, you know, I think that we're lucky, or I was lucky, because at the time I was writing my first edition, it was all major distilleries, and they all go through this, you know, somewhere between 14 and 17 step quality assurance program. So it's, the whiskey's tasted at every different step. So a whiskey like, for example, Golden Wedding, which is hugely popular, probably the best-selling whiskey in Newfoundland, it's a whiskey that I didn't warm up to at first, because it's relatively simple. And you get that, you know, you get those caramel notes, you get the nice peppery notes in the middle, and you get the typical grapefruit pith bitterness at the end, which kind of just refreshes your palate more. And it seemed to me like that was like the archetypical basic Canadian whiskey. But as I drank more and more of it, other nuances started to come out, and I started to see what the attraction was of this whiskey. It wasn't just the price, because it was relatively inexpensive. I did a tour of Newfoundland, and I drank Golden Wedding every day, and gradually came not just to appreciate it, but to enjoy it. So I think some of it is exposure. If you get whiskeys, especially some of the scotches that from independent bottlers, that they really have a fault. Like if you taste baby vomit in a whiskey, there's no way in hell you are ever going to learn to like that. Just pour it down the sink, or, you know, give it to someone you don't like. Then there are other whiskeys. Now, I remember a whiskey in a Talisker that was just ugly, vile, horrible stuff from an independent bottler. And I'll bet you that Diageo is just kicking themselves for letting them put the Talisker name on that bottle. We called it the Pumpkin Talisker because it was orange. And it just went around just kind of destroying the inside of your mouth. And we didn't really like it. And I mean, we had a tradition for a while there. This was with the Plowed Group in the States. We do some kind of a competition or something, and the loser had to take the Pumpkin Talisker home with them. So it was because Talisker for ages was my very, very favorite whiskey, and I still think the Talisker 20-year-old is, and I have a bottle at home of the original Talisker 20-year-old that I'm saving for when I retire. So how did I get used to that? Well, I've tasted a lot of things, and I try to look for why other people enjoy them, like Beiju, for example, a whiskey that a spirit that many people just would spit out. Gins, well, I love some gins because they're really nicely made. And you know what? It's really interesting is that it seems to take a while to get good at making gin. And, you know, I've tasted a lot of gins that the first glass is great, the second glass is great, but by the time you finish the bottle, you don't want to buy another one. Mm-hmm. But there are others, and these generally are the ones that have been out there for a long time, like Beefeater, for example, or Tanqueray, or, gins like that, that, you know, you'll buy another bottle and keep it in the fridge for when my dad comes over, you know, and I serve it cold. I like it served cold, and either in a martini glass as a martini, or with a little bit of sherry, of course, and or just gin and tonic. And I think that it's important to really expand and experience new flavors, and I've been actively doing this for most of my life. I think I've probably carefully tasted and eaten more types of meat than most people I know. I've tasted some really strange things. I once had a dinner of spiders.
Oh.
That was surprisingly flavorful. I thought it tasted a little bit like coconut, quite honestly. I could get that. And I did not. I've eaten a large snake. What is it? It's not a boa, another one. Anyways, I've eaten that, which was quite flavorful, but different. Crocodile, I thought was horrible.
Yeah,
I couldn't get over that. Yeah. Oh, you've had crocodile too? Yeah. You know what? It's that texture. The, you know, it's like cartilage or something like that.
Spongy.
Just didn't get that. I hate kangaroo. I don't know. To me, it tastes like kangaroo poo.
Ostrich. Ostrich is an undervalued meat in North America.
Pardon me?
It's very undervalued in North America because if you have it anywhere else that serves ostrich, they'll serve it to you raw and it's delicious. But North America, you're not going to eat a raw bird because you think you're going to die. It's such a delicious meat.
Ostrich meat is sensational. So what I'm saying to you, Mark, is that I've been exploring all these different flavors and trying to find what people enjoy about these. And it's the same with whiskey. And we're kind of blessed in whiskey in that because we do have such great quality control in most of the distilleries, you don't get very many that are actually bad unless they come from an independent bottler.
Yeah. Tell us what the last whiskey tasted. What's
Port Mourant.
Yeah.
El Dorado Port Mourant. This is from a double wooden pot still. This rum, by the way, is made in Guyana, which is a Caribbean country right on the coast of northern South America. It's a really an interesting place. It's used to be British Guyana, and so you go in there. The language is English. Very colorful. Very, very wonderful, friendly people. These countries are a lot more advanced and developed than we might imagine sitting up here in Canada. And you get some truly skilled people who come through and make wonderful kinds of drinks. And this rum distillery, I think, is probably one of the... it certainly is the best that I know of. This Port Mourant that we're drinking now, Port Mourant is the typical Demerara rum that the British Navy used to serve. They specifically bought Port Mourant and used to serve it to their sailors. Of course, that tradition was discontinued because people thought that you shouldn't drink on the job, which is kind of would put me out of business.
I was going to say, that's...
Do you drink on the job, Mark? I bet you a dollar you have to if you're going to write those books.
Nicole's been teaching the kids to say, "Daddy, drink whiskey in morning." Because as you and I know, if you're doing whiskey tasting notes, you're probably doing them in the morning. And they see me drinking whiskey in the morning. But Nicole's like, "Tell people, Daddy, drink whiskey in morning."
I'm glad your wife has a good sense of humor.
She does. She does.
I met Nicole at Tales of a Cocktail.
Yes,
I remember.
She did.
And she was a new bride at the time. I think you guys were married the week before. In Hawaii, were you? Or you went to Hawaii for your honeymoon and then you came to... You came to Tales of the Cocktail, and this woman, she looked a little bit dazed, and like, holy crow, 20,000 people at Tales of the Cocktail, all of them are interested in only two things, spirits and cocktails, and then there's her husband, and I thought, my goodness, what a wonderful woman. She's been married a week, and she lets her husband go to a booze show with 20,000 people. But anyway, she's a cool person. I like her.
She's really great.
Yeah,
she's my better half. She's a teacher by trade. So you know, she does good in the world, and I write about whiskey. Different kind of good.
Yeah.
So, Devin, thank you for coming on. We'll wrap up. But before we wrap up, we're going to do a special recording for Patreon supporters. So you're going to tell a very special story, but that'll be available on Patreon, on our Patreon supporters. Thank you so much for coming on, and buy Devin's book. I pre-order the next book. I'm very much looking forward to it. I didn't know it was available for pre-order. I'm going to do that next. So important for authors to get the pre-orders in. Follow Devin on Twitter and on Instagram.
DAVINDEK. Or that's my Twitter handle and my Instagram handle. Go ahead, follow me. The names of my books: Canadian Whiskey, The New Portable Expert. That's available everywhere you can buy books. And if not, you can order it online, order it on Amazon. My new book, The Definitive Guide to Canadian distilleries. My co-author is Blair Phillips, who's a Canadian editor for Whiskey Magazine. And Mark's book, The Whiskey Cabinet, also available in the same places. They all make wonderful Christmas presents, and we'd just be delighted to have your support. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dan, for coming on. Cheers.
Cheers.